I remember that I moved houses like 6 years ago, and I got in my old mailbox, like I moved a couple of streets. So I usually take some walks during the day, and I was taking a walk and I looked at my old mailbox and there was a box sticking out because it wouldn't fit. And I said, that's probably a Kickstarter for me, but because I moved houses, it came back to the old house. So I went there and it was a Kickstarter for me.
Hey, thanks for listening. Well, the eclipse has come and gone, and I hope everyone who wanted to see it got to see it. We had a completely overcast day, so it kind of got grayish and purple for a little while, and that's about it. Been in a groove with the new book draft. As of tomorrow, I should hit 60,000 words, so a little under 2 months. So the pace has been pretty good, but I'm overwriting a ridiculous sum. So I have to figure out how to be a little more focused for the final two acts of the book, because it'll be a lot of work to cut down my first slog into it. This week's guest is Andre Lima Araujo. This is pretty exciting for me. As I say in the episode, I came across his work, I think on Twitter. I'm sure it was something that Brian Michael Bendis retweeted because they're working together right now. I was just flabbergasted how cool the work was. It was like seeing Otomo and Shiro and Mobius coming together for some sort of art jam piece, but it's not an art jam piece. It's three graphic novels. I bought the first one right after I discovered the work, devoured it, and I just got book two mailed to me. So I am in the middle of reading it, and it's as wonderful as the first. So I can't wait to see where it goes. Yeah, and if you're not familiar with Andre's work, check it out. Find him online or order the books. We talk about his story and pitch development process, which I think is really unique. How he comes up with a pitch and what he does, I think is pretty brilliant. If you are a person who's thinking about making a pitch, this might be some great advice or at least direction. We talk about film and social media, video games, anime, comic books, obviously. Kind of go after the Transformers movies. So apologies to Michael Bay and fans of Michael Bay. Though we do, I think we exonerate ourselves at the end. But hey, man, if you like it, you like it. That's cool by me. Yeah, and you know, check out his previous work, Righteous Thirst for Vengeance with Rick Remender. And then his current work, which we talk about, is Phenomena with Brian Michael Bendis. I really do recommend him. All right, this is me with Andre Lima Araujo. I guess you were really doing some quality pushing for the comic. This is ridiculously cool stuff, and I think everybody was agog looking at it.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, this is somebody I want to speak with, so I was compelled to chase you down.
No, listen, social media is basically where I carved my career, at least a good portion. It's thanks to social media to existing, because I live in Portugal, north of Portugal. I don't know anyone that does comics. I don't know anyone that works in comics or is remotely related to it. All the connections were made by me and through social media, like a good portion of them.
Wow. I think that's exactly what it's not the work aspect, but I think the result is what the intention would hopefully be. Like, we can actually, like, did you ever have a pen pal when you were a kid? You know, you had, like, you wrote letters to a friend.
Funnily enough, I did have a pen pal of sorts, which was a writer, an American writer.
Okay.
And it happened in the beginning of like the internet as we know it, where suddenly like it was way before social media, but suddenly like people had websites and the website said, contact me, and you had their form. So I read a book by a guy called William H. Keith, okay, is the name that he signs with. And he wrote a bunch of books for, what's the name of it? Battle Tech.
Oh.
So it's a science fiction. You know that?
I think I know. What
you... So it's a property that has, it's an IP that has a bunch of games, board games, you know, and a bunch of books. And he wrote those books for a while. And he did a saga called the Grace and Death Carlyle Saga, which was the main character of the saga. It was pretty cool, and I was fascinated with it. I was like 13 years old, something like that. And I'm embarrassed to think that I would write, you know, like, but back then I thought it was a great idea. Yeah. And it turned out it was, because I wrote him an email. I tracked him down online. Mm-hmm. I wrote him an email, and he responded, and he was super nice. And that was my first big point of contact with an author as a fan. Yeah. So like that left a big mark on me as a blueprint on how to treat your readers, because he was super nice. And then we kept, you know, going back and forth, because at that age, I was already very intent on doing stories, mm-hmm, of some sort. And because I was reading a bunch of science fiction novels, I thought I might as well try to write a book. So I was always playing with ideas in my head, and I asked him a bunch of questions about science fiction and about this, and I told him, what do you think of this and of that? And he was always answering me. And it was like a back and forth that lasted for like a couple of years. And recently, like a couple of years ago, I wrote him an email. I said, hey, remember that stupid kid that wrote you an email once? I now work on comics and just wanted to thank you, because it was really nice what you did by replying me and all that. It left, and he said, hey, I do remember you. It's nice to get in touch again. And so it was a nice thing. It was a sort of pen pal.
That's amazing. And I, you know,
yeah,
I so believe that, you know, when you get some sort of external support at a young age, when you're sort of engaging, yeah, in whatever the creativity act is, and there's someone there who says like, hey, keep going. Go for it. Or, you know, even if they don't say you're doing a great job, they're just really encouraging. It's worth everything. It's worth everything.
No, it's sometimes I just, in fact, this conversation is nice, because just like this week, or like not this week, I think it was yesterday, that I saw a tweet and I retweeted it. And I said exactly that. I said sometimes, and I will explain what the tweet was that I retweeted. I quote retweeted it. And I said, sometimes people have no idea the impact that a couple of words have on a life of an artist. And it was about Inoue, the manga author of Vagabond, mm-hmm, and Slam Dunk. You know, he is famous for making extraordinary stories and great drawings and all that. But he's especially famous for drawing hair, the way that he draws hair. You know, on Vagabond, which is a samurai story, like you have all the very detailed hair. And he told that the only reason why my hair is so well done is because his grandfather, when he was a kid, looked at the way that he was drawing and said, hey, you draw really nice hair. So he just obsessed with that, mm-hmm, and he kept working on it and on it and on it. And now it's one of the things that really distinguishes his work.
I love that.
And just, yeah, it's a great story. And it's true. Like for me, when that guy got back to me, you know, as a 13-year-old, you don't think, I was super excited about it. Okay, I was going crazy about the email, but you don't really think about the steps that go on an adult's head in order to get back to a 13-year-old kid and say, hey, that's cool, nice. You know? And now as an adult, sometimes I look back and I think that's really cool that happened to me, because if I had a really bad experience, for example, with him, you don't know how I would approach authors again. And like for me, I always go, even today, like in my career, the relationships with people like, well, in Brian Bendis' case, he came to me, but Rick Remender, I went to him, mm-hmm, and I went to Marvel, and I went to a bunch of writers that I've stayed in touch with. And I said, hey, my name is Andrea, and I show them my work. And it's because of that, you know, of good experience that I've had throughout my life that really encourage me to just be upfront and just say, if you want to work with someone, go ahead and say. Mm-hmm. and mention and say hello and all that and introduce yourself. It's good for the job and for establishing relationships. And it comes back from, you know, people like William Keefe and being so nice to me.
Yeah. I mean, I guess they have that, whatever that phrase is, paying it forward. But I think that this is the case. And, you know, it's funny. I've seen just in the last 3 days, you know, a bunch of people on Twitter and maybe, you know, maybe on different platforms, but doing that kind of reminder, like, hey, if you like somebody something, just retweet it, you know, repost it, put it back out there, because there's a good chance that there's someone that you know who will like it, but don't have no idea it exists. And I think that's the, you know, I think that network of confirmation that we get from somebody, like when a friend says, oh man, you really have to watch this show or read this book or whatever the thing is, you're way more likely to do that because you trust that person. And, you know, and don't repost everything, because then nobody isn't going to know what to think of what you do. But have a little decorum. But it's great, and it's beautiful to hear that, because, you know, there are too often we hear the stories the opposite, where we hear somebody saying something not positive, and that's unfortunate, because we all kind of want, you know, that child in us to all be nurtured and, you know, and encouraged to do the thing that we kind of desire to do.
Yeah, because some people say don't meet your heroes, but I've had great experiences meeting my heroes, not only in case of email, but even in like face to face. I had chance, because of the work that I do, go to comic conventions and stuff like that, and you will face some of the people that you grew up with, and you have like 25, 30 years of reading their stuff, and then suddenly they are there in front of you.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's a weird experience, because he has no idea who you are, or she has no idea who you are. And there you are, like babbling like a baboon.
I love your work, man.
And nobody knows really what to say. But in the end, I think it's a nice thing. At least it can kickstart some kind of relationship. Sometimes it happens. It happened to me with a couple of them. With others, I just had the chance to say, hello, I love your work, and that was it. But at least that was that. And I know that, as an author myself, I know that sometimes you really don't know what to say, because somebody comes to you and says, I love your work, it's an honor to meet you. I was at the Comic-Con Portugal like 2 days ago. And I was arriving to sign autographs. You know, I had a table and it was my hour, and I was arriving, and next to my table was a huge line, and there was no one on my table. And then I said, God damn, that guy has a lot of people. And then I suddenly realized that they were next to my table, and that was my line. And I was said, oh, it's for me. And I was surprised, like you get surprised by these things. And then a bunch of people coming saying, oh, it's an honor to meet you and all that. And sometimes you don't even know what to say, but in the end it means a lot. So I like to say to other creators as well, those that I really like, you know, I like to tell them for them to know that I appreciate the work and all that, because I know that it matters.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a, I mean, I guess somebody was talking about, I guess, memories of whatever, you know what it's like being a comic book artist, and I wrote all I remember is being really tired. I just remember being so tired because I was drawing all the time, and my hand would hurt. And it was that kind of memory. And so it's kind of that lonely, the act is lonely and thankless, you know? And, you know, when you get the opportunity to interact with your peers, who definitely are the greatest support network when you're doing it, you know, they're the ones who are saying, this is great, or keep on going, or whatever, or your hands suck, do better. But, you know, getting somebody on the outside of that circle to say, oh, I love this. You know, it's so, you know, your tank gets filled right back up. It's like, oh, okay, I know, because I love these things and somebody else loves it. That's the circle. That makes it all complete.
Yeah, and it's especially true when you're like meeting them for the first time. Mm-hmm. So like someone that you never saw, and they came, like it happened to me when I was signing a bunch of books. And so people come, for example, and I saw more than one people had all the issues of Righteous Thirst for Vengeance, mm-hmm. and they had the collections for me to sign. So 11 issues plus two books. And that's like $100. No, it's much more than that. Yeah, so it's like a lot of money spent on my books, and the collections are redundant if you have the issues, mm-hmm. because the collections that they had were not even the special edition, so they don't have any extras. It's just a trade paperback. So they bought all that stuff, and then they were discussing bits of the book, you know, like really details, and you start to see that they not only bought this, but they read it carefully, and they noticed all of these details that I put a lot of work into. Like, it worked. You establish a perfect connection with the reader. That's the most rewarding that it can get, because you have no idea if the person analyzed your comic thoroughly or not. And then when you find out that they did and that they really enjoyed it, and particularly in that book, which is very much about the storytelling, mm-hmm. like when people come telling me that they really liked it, I know that they really picked up on the juice of it,
yeah.
you know? So it's extremely rewarding really to meet readers, because you, like, it's like I was saying before, you about me reading someone's work for years and then meeting them, and it's the other way around. So they meet me for the first time. I never saw them, but they have been reading all my books until up to that point. So it's really interesting to then suddenly understand that you never met that person, but they know like a good portion of you really well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like a great way to establish a connection.
Yeah, totally. It's, you know, I mean, we do, as, you know, fans of anything, we invest a lot of ourselves into what we like. So if it's a, you know, band, uh-huh. or, you know, a musician, or a movie, it's not hard for us to really kind of go deep and connect, you know, make this connection, which is important. And, you know, there's so many, like, there are books, I mean, Andre, there are books that I read, you know, 45 years ago that just live inside me, you know, completely rent free, and I love them. Some of them I'll never read again because I have a suspicion they may not hold up to my, you know, 10-year-old mind, but I'm not going to ruin that dream. But, there are many that I've gone back, and they're just like, they're brilliant. And you go, well, this is everything I want. So
yeah. I love when it happens. I love when I get, even with movies and books and all that, because I'm like you, I have stuff that I read like 20 years ago and that like blew my mind, mm-hmm. but I never reread it again. I don't reread or rewatch a lot of stuff that I really like. Yeah. Like I love Kubrick, and I haven't seen like 2001, which is one of my favorite movies ever. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen it in like 15 years at this point, but I remember like most of it really well. So that's one of the reasons why I didn't watch it. But same thing for Blade Runner, for example. But those I know that will hold up well. But it's really great when I watched Mad Max Fury Road on the theaters when it came out. And like I was telling my wife, this is one of the greatest things that I ever mm-hmm. saw in my life. And then I rewatched it like a year ago or something. And I was again completely blown away by it. Yeah. I was watching it and I couldn't believe how well made that thing was. Like I was just mind blown, probably even more than the first time, because then you know this, like, you know what's coming with the story,
right.
And you know the pace. So I was prepared for that. So I was noticing all the other little details, mm-hmm. and just like, that's a perfect experience, I think, when you go back to something and it's even better than you remember. Same thing with Heat. I rewatched Michael Mann's Heat, which I hadn't seen in like 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't believe how good that thing was. And I was watching De Niro and Pacino and I was just mouth open.
Yeah.
And the music and everything, the light, everything was so perfect.
That film is so, you know, near perfect in almost every way. Another film for me in that category would be like Sicario.
That's so good.
I can watch that movie all the time. It always like delivers something to me every time.
Yeah, I love that movie. You know, One of my favorite things was that the main character, which is hard to pinpoint to who the main character is, but like the movie like plays a lot of tricks with you. One of them is it gives you Emily Blunt as supposedly the main character, and she has no agency in anything that happens. She's just there for the ride. Like she has whatever she might tries to do, like nothing happens her way. Like she's nothing. She's a passenger. And the movie plays with that notion because it presents you her character as kind of the hero, but then you know, it's, oh no, she's not that. And this is not that kind of movie.
No.
And then kind of in the end, you kind of get that it's Del Toro is the one that makes everything happen. Yeah. And it's because of him that the story is developing. And he really is guy like the guy in the corner that almost doesn't talk in the beginning. And for most of the movie, don't get much from him. I love when a story pulls those two kinds of tricks. Oh,
it really is one of my absolute favorite films of the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. I can't get enough. And I mean, I think his Blade Runner 2049 or whatever the number was, like, I really enjoyed that film from top to bottom as well.
It was very good.
Yeah. I think he's just, you know, he's doing the great movies.
He's a visionary. That's what he is. He knows what he wants from a movie, and you can tell. I think that's the thing really that sets like a guy like Villeneuve apart and makes him one of the top tier directors, I'd say right now. That you can tell that you might not like his movie, but he definitely has a vision for what he wants.
Yeah. No, I agree. And he also, I mean, while I'm, you know, a total science fiction, you know, nerd, I love it that he does films, you know, that aren't science fiction, that he goes outside of that genre and he'll tell these really like hard gripping stories about people. And you're like, you know, good on you, man. Like you really, yeah. And I guess the reason I'm kind of circling on this is that you've mentioned it twice. In regard to your being a child and wanting to tell stories, and then somebody citing storytelling in your work as from a fan's point of view. And was that the chief driver for you when, you know, you
always
okay, so what is it about the storytelling for you that is the compelling aspect?
For me, it's the story. Like I started noticing, you know, when I was growing up, like everything that really interested me had a story in it. So like, for example, I play a lot of video games, not so much these days because three small kids and a lot of work, but all of them, all of my favorite video games and all the ones that I was driven towards were story games, like Japanese RPGs like Final Fantasy and Metal Gear Solid when I was a kid. And like growing up, you start to discover other type of genres, but always the RPG, the open world, the quest structure, the dialogue, the characters, the story that you can play through, you know, the Uncharted type of games, Last of Us, all of that. Then discover things like Elder Scroll and Fallout and eventually The Witcher 3, which became my favorite game ever. So it's like, same thing. Then I love movies and books, and I love the history as a subject. You know, I read a lot of books about medieval history and all that stuff. And it's all just this idea of a narrative, of finding a narrative, because I think that's what makes us tick as a person. I think that's what moves us. That's been the core of our existence, basically, just carrying these stories with us that we tell each other. That's how, until very recently, the way that we would pass information. Mm-hmm. So it's ingrained in our survival. And I think that really without a story, there isn't much going on for us. So, and at the same time, as long as you have a story, you're there, you exist. And I think that's probably the more profound reason. But I have this, like, it's like a fire, you know, you need to make something. I don't I don't usually talk much. I'm not the kind of guy that's going to come to a lunch or a dinner and is going to be the one telling stories. Mm-hmm. I don't do that. I really don't feel a big need to talk or any of that. A lot of people that know me like more superficially will always say that I'm very quiet because that's my nature. And I think that's part of that. I imagine, because I'm not a scientist or a shrink or anything, but I imagine that part of that is because I express myself all the time in my work, so I don't have the same need that other people have to just tell a story, just blow some steam, express some kind of emotion. Like I'm doing that all the time in my work, and I feel like that's part of my nature, and it's part of everyone's nature, really. But for me, I always felt that this was the best way to express it. Yeah. And it has always been at the core of my interests in everything, really. I always gravitated towards the best stories with the best characters and not so much about the more stylish stuff with that didn't have the substance of the characters. I started noticing like that stuff doesn't really grab me, or doesn't the one that didn't have good characters, good story, in the end, no matter how flashy it was, it wouldn't leave an impression on me. So all my favorite stuff is from that point of view.
You know, it's when you were saying it earlier and something popped in my head and now you just kind of codified it, that, and it's a broad generalization, so don't eviscerate me, world. But the point being that I think people who create stories kind of come from two camps. In general, I mean, you can cross back and forth, but I think there are the people who get enamored by visuals or fancy language or whatever the thing is that makes them excited. And it's fun. No one's going to deny that looking at a Transformers film isn't exciting to look at. It's designed to be exciting. Yeah. But there's also the other school where you look at a movie and or read a book or read a comic book, and the artwork isn't like, you know, Art Adams' amazing detail artwork or, you know, Otomo's amazing. But it's just like David Mazzucchelli, as example, beautiful artwork, you know, made a perfect comic book series. And like it is, you know, year one, best one, you know, might be the best thing ever done. But it's coming purely from a storytelling driven aspect versus a visual aspect that's dominating it. And I think you can kind of see how these trails move forward in creating things and all sorts of stuff. I mean, like the, you know, flashy musicians who play a lot of guitar solos and craziness and all sorts of things are going on may not be the most structurally competent, you know, songs written, but they're pretty damn exciting.
Yeah, it's... No, because you're reminding me of something that I saw once, and you spoke about Transformers, so it's like the perfect example, because it was a video about why Terminator 2 is so good and why we all talk about it, why do everybody that watches this movie loves it, and the reason is, like, you have the explosions, and the guy that made that video, it was on YouTube, it was an analysis, like a 20-minute analysis to Terminator 2, and it was like, he spoke about the difference between what Michael Bay does and what James Cameron does, with no disparaging to what Michael Bay does, because he does that well. Mm. It's what he chose to do. But Michael Bay catches your attention through the most basic way that we give our attention, which is like if something explodes, your head will turn to that thing, right? Always. Mm-hmm. So in all of his movies, everything is always exploding. That's what gets your attention. Mm-hmm. And in the next scene, something explodes. So it's just a manner of speaking. It's not just that, but it's like it's a visual thing that immediately grabs your attention. And that's how he does it. And then James Cameron doesn't do it like that. You have the explosions, yes. But the reason why that movie lingers in our heads is because the storytelling is perfect, because of all the choice that he made. Like I saw in that video things that I've seen that movie like a few times and I hadn't noticed it. Like in the end, the sequence, when they are on that furnace and the Terminator is fighting the T-1000. The T-1000, I can't remember now which one is which, but let's say that the T-1000 is lit with a red light and the Terminator with a blue light. Always from the beginning to the end of that sequence. And even when the T-1000 reshapes itself into the Terminator appearance, it's still lit with the same red light. So it's like there's that code that you don't see. So like there's a lot of subliminal stuff that James Cameron puts in the movie that goes hand in hand with the explosive sequences and all the action and all of that. Like he he really knows how to tell a story, and that's why his blockbusters are always so like perfectly crafted. And that's the difference between his type of filmmaking and, for example, Michael Bay's filmmaking. And I think like both have a place, yeah. But for me, it's James Cameron.
And I think Cameron also comes down to writing as well. He's very much involved in script. And I think he is going for that human connection in his story. Like, what is important? What is important to a human in this?
Yeah, it's characters.
Right. And so you are compelled to find out what happens to these characters. You know, let's say they're equal when it comes to their, you know, their film craft. You know, they can set a shot up both equally well. They can both light something just as well. They can choose the right lenses. But there's these intangibles that Cameron employs, which just set him above, you know, above the fray of the most, you know, notable action directors.
Yeah. And it's like on Heat, for example, the movie that we were talking before with Michael Mann, like that's a cop chasing a bad guy, basically. That's the story that you get. It's a very basic cop versus bandit. But he makes it so much more than that, because it's like an existential thing that's going on there. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's so much more than those two characters. It's like they are representing what's good and what's bad. And like you start to see that even that is not enough of a description, because it goes back to basically Al Pacino is looking at a reflection when he looks at De Niro, because his wife tells him, you chase what you are, and you are what you're chasing. You cannot let that go. So it's like there's a lot of layers that you can peel away from a movie like that could have focused itself only on the action that's happening, and it will be thrilling enough. But when he adds all that stuff on top, you get just a movie that just never dies, never goes away, and it doesn't leave your head.
Yeah, and that parallel of those characters where, you know, De Niro's character is like, hey, you know, never happened anything in your life that you can't just walk away from, you know, and just turn and walk away. And he, you know, he states this out, you know, out loud, and this is his sort of his mantra. Meanwhile, you know, Pacino's character is, is in a relationship, so he's already in a relationship, but he has no ability to go deeper into it or walk away from it. He can't, like, he's trapped in it in a way that he doesn't know how to navigate out of, and. So he actually isn't the only place he has any agency is in his career by chasing the bone, you know, like he's a dog going after the bone. Everything else is completely falling apart around him, and he has no ability. Meanwhile, De Niro's character is all about this agency. You know, his whole life is about agency. And the second he gives that up is when it all falls apart.
Yeah. Exactly. And even if you look at like Al Pacino, his character is so in the chase that he's completely surprised when his wife just tells him like, this is not working. Mm-hmm. He never thought about that thing not working, because for him, like the wife was there, but the work was the thing. And then he got back home and there she was. And then there's a point where she says, this is not working. You're living with that man in your head and that's all you think about. And he's completely taken aback. And then he actually keeps chasing him and keeps doing his job. And then when he comes home, there's the wife as a lover already. So like he's completely out of the loop. And it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie when he says that you can eat my dinner and you can fuck my wife, but you cannot watch my TV, and takes the television away. It's so perfect, because it's like he lost control of that situation completely, but it's his way of saying that I'm going to win something here tonight, it's going to be my TV.
And it's so... And it's just so such an emasculated action. Like there's no power in it. It is so small, and I love it. I mean, it's now I'm gonna have to watch this movie all over again.
Do it.
So, okay. So you have this compulsion to tell stories, and I get it, man. Like I remember, like all my action figures growing up, it was all about taking those characters and making stories. Like I would just sit there mm-hmm. and play and make up stories for all these things for hours and hours.
Yeah.
And you know, and with friends, I would be like, okay, we're going to go do this. I would, you know, I would construct all these sort of elaborate stories for me and my friends to go do. Poor bastards. But like, what did you like? What like? Can you track a point where you started like saying, I'm like when you started making something and like what were the things that you were thinking about mm-hmm. making? And what were you actually trying to make?
Well, for one, I was exactly doing what you just described, which was with my action figures. I had the Ninja Turtles and the Action Man mm-hmm. figures and all that. My sister had Barbies, you know, the Barbie doll and the Ken, but she never liked very much the type of basic things that you do with a Barbie, which is Barbie goes shopping or Barbie does this. She always preferred to let's mix her toys with mine, and we got a more action-oriented kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So she was always more into that. So we would make up a lot of stories together like that. But ever since I was a kid, I really don't remember start drawing. I just remember that I would draw all the time. In the same way, it's like I don't have a... Some people say, oh, when I found out this book, that's when it turned me into comics. I don't have that as well. I always had comics with mm-hmm. me. Even before I could read, you know, my mother would read me the balloons. So as soon as far as I can remember, I always drew, and I always drew both characters from the stories that I was reading, and the stuff that I really loved always propelled me to make stuff. So when I was like 4, 5, 6, I don't remember me drawing much original characters other than the basic variation of what I was watching, mm-hmm. you know, someone that looked like Rambo but was not Rambo or something like that. Or Ninja Turtles or the Action Man or whatever it was. When I was like after 10 and when I saw Dragon Ball, like that really cracked something. And I remember from that point on, I started doing a lot of sketches and writing notes. But even before in primary school, I was already, I remember like my imagination was always going. I remember creating all types of drawings. Oh, I'm remembering now doing drawings with wrestling figures. I had a friend of mine that really, we both love wrestling, which was not like a phenomenon like you have in the United States at that point mm-hmm. in Portugal. It was more like a couple of nerds liking it or something like that. And it would be the odd guys. But I remember like, because I could draw. So like if I found someone that had something in common with me, they would always be together and we'd be saying things about like, what if this character did this or that? And then I would draw it and everybody would come look, you know? So I would create like these mini stories with figures and characters that we invent on the spot with my friends. And I remember like when I was a teenager, I was full blown just writing type of kind of pitches and drawing characters and all that.
Yeah.
So it was like a process that you kept going.
Okay, so you said at the beginning that you know nobody around you does what you do, you know, in the comic book business. So how did you frame it? Because I mean, I have older sisters, and they asked me like I was 12, and they're like, mm-hmm. What do you want to do when you grow up? And I'm like, I'm going to draw comic books. Like that was my response, and they were like, you know, they had no idea what to do with me. But I had an encouraging family who, you know, was helpful to, you know, sort of foster whatever mm-hmm. foolish ideas I had. But how do you keep that fire and interest going and sort of direct it towards something? Because it's easy to say you want to do something, but doing it mm-hmm. and then actually manifesting it are two very different things.
That's right. Well, the reality was, like I was saying, I always had the comic books next to me. So clearly, like I remember my mom reading the balloons, and she remembers that as well. I don't remember, or I don't know exactly why she bought comic books. I must have asked for it. So it drew me into, like, from a very basic age, certainly, like the drawings and the cartoons. I love all types of cartoons as well. So like from a very basic age, I was surrounded by a lot of that material. Mm-hmm. And I remember like the first comics that I was reading were, or before I could even read, the first comics that I had with me were Disney comics, like Donald Duck.
Yep.
And Donald Duck was my favorite. I never liked Mickey very much. Like the stories of Mickey, I always found them a bit boring. I always liked Donald because Donald was always in bad luck and he always had to fight his way out of whatever
he had stupid problems. Thing
he had done to he himself. Had
real problems.
Yeah, lots of money problems as well because he always had. So like, I remember when I was always drawing, so it was kind of obvious that I would have to do something with it for everyone around me. And I drew really well from a young age. So like I stood out from a very young age, like as an artist. It was pretty clear that I would have to do something with it. So I remember I was like 5 years old and my father's father asked me, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said to him that I was going to draw for Disney. Mm. That was the thing that I said to him. I remember saying it because he found it so funny. Like my grandfather, okay, he was born in 1917 and he grew up in Portugal in a dictatorship in a small town that was pretty much living in the Middle Ages. So fast forward 70 years and his grandson is telling him that he's going to draw for Disney. Like for him, like that blew his mind. Like he started laughing and he told everyone, listen to him. And that's why I remember it because he made a thing out of it. You know, he said to my aunts and stuff like that, like, tell them what you told me. And I would tell them. So like, and for me, it was obvious that I was going to do that, which funnily enough, it's how I began my career, was working, drawing for Disney, which was Marvel at the time. So that's an interesting thing for me that I like to think of. And as I was growing up, for me, it was kind of obvious that it should have to be comics. Then later on, I started reading all kinds of comics, being drawn into Lucky Luke, Asterix. Then I started discovering things like Blueberry from Moebius, like the Western, written by Jean-Michel Charlier and drawn by Moebius. At the time, he was signing Jean Giraud. And then you go and I found out about manga, for example. So like, it blew my mind, you know, Ghost in the Shell and Akira and all that. And all the American comics that I was reading at the time, Spider-Man and such, so old superheroes. You know, like I was growing up and this was kind of obvious that I had to do it. And I always kept doing stories and drawings. But then I was getting older and a bit more realistic about things. And it seemed to me like that thing was going to happen. I was always sure that it was going to happen. I just didn't know when because there was no like connection for me. I didn't know anyone that was doing that. I didn't know no editors, no authors, no fellow artists. I'm from a small town. I still live in the same small town. Like there was literally no one, no open door, no clear path, nothing. And when I was in high school, I went, my parents and me were talking what to do, like, jumping into comics was not a possibility at the time when I was 17, 18. Like that was not going to happen. Right. So I went for architecture school. In my mind, I was going to be an architect for a few years and then publish a comic book. That was what's going to happen, what was going to happen. But it was, as I was going through my degree, social media started to be a thing. So all of a sudden, like, and luckily everyone from comics decided to be on Twitter. So all of a sudden, everybody was there. Yeah. All the authors, all the editors, all the publishers, everyone that I never met in my life, I was suddenly following and listening to their conversations and listening to what they were saying and their advices. And I was starting to draw and post my stuff on places like DeviantArt. And now, and like suddenly you have a few followers and people are talking to you and people are making... On DeviantArt back then, I don't know how the site operates these days, if at all, like it was. But back in the day, you could put your drawings on a page that was specifically then for criticism. You know,
yeah.
So I was doing all of that, so exposing myself, and that really was how the connection started to form. And how suddenly, as I was going through the architectural degree, it was clear to me that the thing that I was saying when I was 5 years old was after all possible, even though I didn't have any kind of connections, because suddenly there they were. So I kept myself fed through the comics that I was reading and through the stories that I was telling, and that always kept me going and excited about making more. And then suddenly when I was starting to be an adult and seeing, oh, this is not going to be that easy, suddenly you get that door that's just there for you to try and take it. And, you know, funnily enough, because I have a lot of, I had a lot of luck throughout my, I've been searching for that luck. So you kind of make it happen as well. Mm-hmm. But the year that I ended my degree, C.B. Cebulski came to Portugal to a small comics festival, and I went there and I met him. And that's how it actually began.
Wow. Well, I mean, to me, it's, you know, it's the classic, you know, you generated your own luck through hard work and focus, and you just kept putting it out there and refining it, not just doing the thing and not being conscious of, I mean, and you, listen, you're in an architecture program, so, you know, open criticism is there. You've learned, you understand how.
Yeah.
So there's no immaturity in that respect. And you, you know, you kind of put it out there. And then ultimately, did you know he was going to be at that show when you were going, or was this a surprise?
No, I just went there because of him.
Oh, okay. So you knew.
Yeah, no. And it's funny that you speak about architecture and criticism, because it's, you're right. Like, sometimes people ask me, like, oh, what did architecture gave you to comics? And it, like, that's the first thing, because I was telling this someone the other day, like, once you go, like, on my degree, at least, and I think that most of them are like this, I had to make a presentation. I had to talk every week with, we had a main class throughout the 5 years of the degree, which is called project, which is basically what being an architect is. You create your project, and they have a set of rules for each one of that you make. And, you know, and then you need to present your project every week to the teacher. He sits on your desk and you will show him what you have, and you will make your criticism. And then you will present it to the class once a month. And then you have a big presentation every 3 months. Okay. So, like, after you go through this for 5 years, there really isn't anything that anyone can tell me about my work that I haven't thought first.
Sure.
There's no chance that you're going to hurt me with a critique
of
any kind, because I can see it from, first of all, like, I know what's wrong with it before everybody says. And even if I haven't noticed for some reason, the moment that you say, I can immediately see if you're right or not, and if it's a fair critique or not. So, like, you are completely prepared for that, and you learn how to manage an artistic process, which is a beast on its own. And I saw many people being taken down by it. Like, a lot of people cannot, and this is one of the most common things with amateurs, which is they cannot go through the conceptual phase.
Yeah.
They can't go, because once you have an idea on your head, the idea is perfect. And then the moment that you type it, it turns into absolute shit. And that happened too in architecture. Like, we'd have, like, I remember we're working on a museum, you know, and you have an actual terrain that the teachers will tell you, it's on this terrain. And it was on the city of the university that I was in. So we would go there and visit the terrain. And then we were all assigned to that piece of land, and we had to build a museum on it. And I remember drawing it was like a spiral, you know, my idea for a museum. Not really, but it worked like that. And everybody loved that drawing. And then I made a small model, just picked up a few pieces and did it just like I did in the drawing, because I was already drawing well. So, like, I did the 3D drawing. I knew what I wanted it to be. Came out great. This was at the conceptual stage, you know. And then came the moment to put some measures in it. And I noticed, you know, this looks great, but this is like 30 meters tall and it needs to be half that size. So once I reduced it and I started to, you know, adjust everything, it turned into a pile of crap completely. Mm-hmm. And that moment, the temptation to just restart is immense. And you will learn that you cannot do that. Like, you had a good idea, Now you have to make it work.
Right.
You cannot go back because you're going to have another good idea and it's not going to work once you try to make it happen. It's supposed not to happen because that's how it goes. Then you need to rework it as much as you can and try to get it back to that early stage again and try to understand what made it work and what is now failing.
Right.
And try to recover that. And that's really the process of creating. And if you don't know that, you're going to create a story and you're going to have a great idea and you're going to take some notes and all of it is going to sound and look delicious and perfect. And then when you try to assemble the proper story and put some structure into it, you're going to see that there's a bunch of plot holes and there's this character that should have been there and it's not. And now, oh my God, I'm going to need another character. And now you introduce another character and it's just a mess and these are the complications that you learn. You learn to love that.
You have to.
I do love a problem. I do love a problem in a story to solve. That's one of my favorite things. I remember when we were making Righteous Search for Vengeance, me and Rick, we would constantly talk about what happens in the issues. And when there was some moments when we were like on a Zoom talk, you know, and we'd go, oh, does this character die now? I remember asking him that.
Right.
And he told me, I don't know. What do you think? And I said, oh, but if she dies, then I think it's too soon, I remember telling him. But it was a car chase, and we had her escaping a car chase like a couple of issues back. So I told him, we cannot have her escape two car chases, or otherwise it's going to look like a Looney Tunes cartoon. So she's going. Yeah. And like we decide that, and then how is this going to happen? And what kind of consequences is this going to have for the rest of the story? And how does this frame what happened before as well? So like, you know, that can be a lot of potential troubles. But as a storyteller, you learn to live with that and to really embrace that stuff as the core of what you do. You solve problems.
Yeah, and the story, it tells you what it needs. Like when you're making it and you come to these moments and you go, oh shit, I did not anticipate this. Like someone needs to walk through the door right now and say something. Yeah. And it's none of the characters I've made up to this point, you know? And that may require you to do some, you know, some work in the back, you know, and maybe infer that this other character does exist and it's not some sort of ex machina kind of thing where it's just, hey, here's your solution. But these kind of things happen and you have to constantly, like I'm drafting a new novel right now and it's a mystery. Mm-hmm. And I went from writing science fiction fantasy to writing a mystery. And I love the genre, but man, the other week I told my buddy, like, it's really fucking hard to write a mystery because every little piece, every piece matters. Everything matters. So everybody's got a timeline. Every single timeline has to mesh. It has to come together. It's rough. I love it, but it's rough.
Yeah, and it, particularly when you get into the fine details, for example, of a mystery, you need to start. I think that you start to wonder, like, are people going to either notice this or is this too much reveal?
Yeah.
Am I revealing too much? Are they going to piece this out on the first third of the book and then you got nothing? There's a lot of thinking like that we do in our stories. And then sometimes you need to go back. And then I learned also that on the architectural degree, like one of my classes in the last year, I remember one of my teachers was speaking to all of us and he was saying, okay, guys, I'm going to be honest with you. You're going to have to do this, this, and this. And it was like a big class. It was on history of architecture, of Portuguese architecture. So it was like a big one on the last year. And he told us, when you have all the elements, you will need to probably remake a bunch of stuff because of what you did in the end, and you need to make it all fit together. So kind of like you're telling a story and you need to make this thing proper, okay? And he told, you cannot have the cowardice, I remember this was his words, of not rereading what you have already written.
Wow, okay.
You cannot cower from doing that. You need to go back because you're going to find trouble. You know that you are, which is why you would avoid, you know, doing it. And I think that like that's sometimes you say that to someone and they will say, well, then this is not for me.
Yeah.
And then you tell that to someone else and it's like you lit a fire and they so you're challenging me. You're challenging me. Is that what you're doing?
Totally.
Yeah, I'm going to fuck this shit up.
No.
And that's how and it was on my last year that I found out that about me. Like, if you say something, like, if you tell me, like, we need this done, but I'm not entirely sure if you can,
right.
Then that's a challenge to me that I cannot back away from.
I mean, it's like, he hits you with a glove, and he's got his sword at his side. Like, you are going to draw your sword. Like, it is going to happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And that teacher, he was very, he was one of my favorite teachers ever. But he also spoke in a very theatric kind of way, dramatic. Mm-hmm. So he was explaining what you'd have to do. And then suddenly he lowered his voice and he started calming. He knew how to tell a story, And he started saying, you cannot be a coward and not reread what you did. Mm-hmm. And then he stopped talking and we all stood there in silence. So we let that sink in, just to make sure that we would remember it. So that in the end, if we didn't do it the proper thing, he would tell us, and he said, I told you so.
Yeah, and an amateur.
But it was a good lesson.
Yeah, and an amateur is unwilling to go back in and do what it takes to make it work. And that's where when you've crossed over from being an amateur to a pro is – you get some sort of external feedback which doesn't match your magic image in your head. And you have to then say, all right, I have to go back in and I have to go fix this. And you're willing to do it. And and not only are you willing to do it, but you want to do it because you need to do it because this thing has to be completed.
No, you can't let it go. It's like, if you spot something that doesn't work, or if someone points something that you haven't noticed, you need to address it in some way, shape, or form. That's how it goes.
Yeah.
And I think it adds work. Yes, it does. But you will learn a lot from it because it will, if you look at it from that critical point of view and don't take it personally, which is a hard thing to do in the beginning. Very hard because we are pouring these things from our heart and souls, and then suddenly someone comes and says, "Yeah, man, I like this, but there is this bit here that's just so stupid. Why does this character does that?" And then you try to explain, and the more you explain, the more stupid it sounds to
it
you.
Falls
and then
you start getting mad. It totally falls apart in your mouth.
Yeah, and you see, and then you get angry at yourself. How could I be so dumb to make this character do this stupid thing? And you feel stupid. Yep. You do. I remember. On Righteous Third for Vengeance, for example, in the end, like Rick is a great storyteller. And I remember we hit it from the get-go. Like I knew what he wanted from the story and I knew what I wanted from the story. And I started working on it. And I remember we had never worked together, never before doing that, which like for all these other collaborations, he had worked with the artists at Marvel, for example, doing whatever he was doing at Marvel. So like all of them came with him from that place. So we knew how they operated, but we didn't know how we operated. I wanted to work with him. He wanted to work with me. And then we started doing the book and that was it. And we decided what to do, how to do it. And we started drawing. I remember I got his script. It was great. I drew thumbnails and he told me this is great for issue 1. And we started drawing and we had it. And then we went to issue 2. And in the end of issue 2, the scene that he wrote was not, he had some doubts about a couple of panels and a couple of things. And then I tried to come up with a solution and I drew it and it was bad because it was not the thing that we had done up until that point. And then I felt stupid and he felt stupid and we both felt really dumb at some point. And I particularly felt dumb because the drawing that I made was really not a good story moment. And was not at all what the story was asking for. And then we squeezed it. And when he said, just let me try to retype a few things. And he rewrote it. And then I redrew it based on what he told me. This is on the thumbnail phase, obviously, on layouts phase still. But we got like a great ending for issue 2. But we had to go through that. Am I dumb or something? Because I did really something stupid here that has nothing to do with what I was doing up until this point, you know? So I think those are good moments. And then you learn, because we never had the same mistake again. Neither. He knew where to go. I knew where to go. And that was it for us. And it was funny that it didn't happen in the beginning. It happened already in the end of issue 2. But it was then that we were 90% there, and then we got 100% there.
And that's the thing, maybe it was, presumptuous of you to, do that, sort of visual rewrite yourself. But if you hadn't done that and you just drew what was in the script, that 90% good thing would have gone through, and that could have been fine. But because you challenged it, and even though you fell short of a solution, a better solution was found because something you called something out by making that effort.
Yeah, because I remember that I did a drawing. Like, this character was a bit... It was with a character that was an assassin, and it was a bit colorful, let's put it like that, while everything else in the book was very subdued and realistic, and this one was a bit more out there. And at that point, I picked him up, and in the end of the issue, I turned him almost into a Quentin Tarantino crazy character, of that type. And we really weren't doing that type of book. So that's why it felt so off to Rick, for example. And to me, when he pointed out, I said, obviously, this is really stupid. This is really dumb. This doesn't work. So, but it's a good... That's why I like working with him a lot, which is like, if he likes it, he will tell you. And if he doesn't like it, he will tell me as well.
Yeah.
And I do the same thing. Gut, if something is not working...
And your gut tells you, like, it's all about tone. Like, a shift in tone for anything, if it doesn't actually work, it's just going to be discordant. Like, if you shifted key,
it puts you off.
If you shifted key in your in a song and it doesn't have a resolution to it or a purpose, it just sounds like this really very odd, like, what is happening kind of moment. And we've all seen it in a movie, or in a television show, when all of a sudden things just kind of change. You're like, why are they like, this feels really odd.
I feel like one of the worst moments for me in a TV show or in a movie is when I start looking, like, I can forgive a lot of stuff, but the one that just it turns me off completely is when I started looking at a character and thinking, why, or saying, why is he doing that? Or why didn't he do that other thing? And when you ask that question, for me, it's like, unless there's a good answer coming, that's it. It broke the illusion completely. It fell apart.
Yeah, I think that's a very amateur storytelling, thing, where people just kind of, they write whimsically, and all these sort of like these things happen with characters, and you go, well, none of this stuff makes sense. It's all very, disconnected, and it's,
For me, I can break it down that what really, when I end up asking, why is this character doing this, is usually because it's pretty clear then once the thing wraps up that whoever wrote it, like, set something up without knowing how to resolve it. So then they find themselves in a point where you need to come up with some kind of solution, because this thing that we... this mystery that we set up in the beginning doesn't really have an explanation. So now we need to come up with some kind of explanation. And that's really when you go and you see, as I'm watching it, like I say, this is a very stupid explanation to the thing that I was so excited to find out about in the beginning. And it's pretty clear that whoever wrote this never thought about the ending, just wanted to set something cool up, and that was it. And it's usually that's the problem.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, when you write a, when you create a story, you create a world, you create a world in this story, and this world has its own particular physics. And these laws of physics, you establish them at the beginning of the story and you adhere to them throughout the story. If you break these laws of physics, it really tells the, you know, the reader, the viewer, the listener, whatever it is, it tells them you don't care. And that's a really dangerous place to put yourself in when you're making something and sharing it with other people.
Yeah, that's what I was. That's a good example of what I was speaking about earlier. For example, in Righteous Thirst, when we were saying, "Are we going to kill this character now?" And that's when I was. I remember telling Rick, "No, we are creating a world that has consequences and dire consequences for the things that are happening. It's a violent story, and like they are stepping into a world that's very violent, full of assassins, the dark web, all of that stuff. So like, they managed to escape a car chase." And now we have a second car chase, and you can't have the same thing happen, because otherwise you're starting to get cartoony and going away from the thing that the rule that we established, that this has consequences. So this is it.
Yeah.
Like, she's going to die now sooner than we wanted, but sooner than we had planned in the beginning, but it is what the story came to, because it's like when you are building and you follow the rules. And I think that you have a kind of ending inside him, but even if you don't know precisely what is going to happen, but like if you know that you want the story to end on this place with this character alive and or dead or whatever it is, and with getting the thing or not getting the thing and why, so you get the theme and the kind of plot sorted out in some kind of sense, then you can allow yourself to make these kind of decisions in the middle. As long as you follow the rules, and you can go on diverging paths that will eventually lead to the thing that you had in mind. And it might be a transformed thing, but you have a kind of goal, might be foggy, might be very clear, depending on what episode that you are telling. But I think that you should have a goal in mind.
Yeah.
And then you follow, like you said, you adhere to the rules and you make it happen. And I think as a reader, for me, that's really what I want from the story. Is like, I want set up the rules and then follow them, because it's so exciting when you, for example, are watching a TV show or a movie where the rules have been set clearly, and you start seeing something happen, and you start to think, oh my god, this character is gonna die. Like, there's no way that he is gonna escape, and then it happens and you still can't believe it, but you feel fulfilled because the show made you a promise and kept it, or the book make you a promise and kept it. And like, one of my favorite comic books ever was Sculpt, from Guerra and what's the name of Jason Aaron, the writer. And it's like a super intense police undercover story, and it has its rules, and it's a dire world as well. It's a very violent world that this cop is in. He's in on an Indian reservation, a Native American reservation, you know, and he's like there, and it's everything is dangerous, poverty, all of that. So it's like, it's a tough world, and the book makes you its promises, and then it sticks to the consequences. And I love that about that book. It's like, from the beginning to end, you always get what you promised. Yeah.
It's a great lesson to adhere to when you are making something, to be very cognizant of this stuff as you proceed, because while the preciousness of the characters that we create, you know, we don't want them to go away, but sometimes they need to go away to make the greater whole, the greater sum of the story to work better. That's terrible. Work better, to be better. So speaking of stories coming to you, and you mentioned it earlier, so Bendis came to you. So was it in a great light?
Yeah.
Like, was there a big light fills the room, and then all of a sudden Brian appears from the center of this light?
You appear to me in a dream.
Yes.
No. What happened? It's just funny because, again, it's like we were speaking, like sometimes these things happen to me in my career. It's like a bit of luck. But you know what they say, you know, luck is opportunity meeting preparedness. And it's like if you want this thing to work, whatever it is that you have in your dreams, if you are prepared to it, whenever the opportunity comes, you can take it and go. And I wanted to meet Bandit for like a couple of years because he was coming to Portugal and he missed it because first year he was coming to Comic-Con Portugal. And I actually had a portfolio to show him because I never met him up until that point. And my first gig at Marvel was supposed to be with him.
Okay.
So we kind of were destined to do something together in a way. So like I was thought that would be funny that we would finally reconnect a few years later, but I had no idea that he knew about me. But then he missed his first voyage to Portugal because of some passport situation. Then he got seriously ill. You might remember mm-hmm. that. And in the next year, so he didn't come. And then what happened was that while I was trying to somehow, in some kind of way, present my work to him, he knew about my work and he wrote me. And that was cool. And I got an email from him to work with him on his launch for Legion of Superheroes at mm-hmm. DC. And he did a couple of issues that were called the Legion of Superheroes Millennium, if I remember mm-hmm. correctly. And they had guest artists. Each one was drawing like five page sections. And it was people like Jim Lee and all the other great artists at DC. And then there was me, who never worked at DC, which I found very curious and funny. And he asked me, "Do you want to draw? Is it going to have Jim Lee and this and that?" I said, "Sure, I want to draw."
So.
It. So I drew those. Yeah, I guess I can, you know, I'll allow it. And then I drew it. And we, like, it worked really well between me and him. And I told him, listen, because at that point, I was supposed to work with Rick Remender. We already knew, but he was doing the Dead Class show, mm-hmm. and he was the showrunner. So like he told me, listen, I cannot make the comic that we were supposed to make right now. I cannot take any more work. So I started looking at other avenues to put out some creator-owned stuff. And when I did that short thing with Brian, I told him, listen, we should do something else together if you want. I really enjoyed these five pages. And he told me, oh, nice. You want to do some Batman or Superman? I said, no, I don't want to do any of that. I want to do creator own work. Do you want to do that? And he told me, oh, nice, because I also want to do more. And that was like we began immediately working on Phenomena.
So how did that come to – was it a conversation? Did he like say, hey, I've got this crazy idea? Or was it you brought some clay and he brought some clay and you guys are going to mesh together?
It was a funny thing. Like we were, because I also write stuff. So I had a bunch of pitches at that time. And again, in my career, everything happens at mm-hmm. once. So like I had sent a bunch of pitches to publishers who had not come back to me. And eventually they came back to me and said, we want to do some of this, mm-hmm. but I was already working with Brian. So I showed him the pitches as well. And so this is the stuff that I've been working on in the past, like couple of years. Stories of mine that I had text and artwork for. I always, the way that I create a pitch is I create the story and then I make like a five page thing that's like a movie mm-hmm. trailer so that I can showcase all the main bits of the story and have a few captions on it, like a narration. Yeah. So if you're an editor, you will pick it up and read those five pages fairly quickly and you get immediately a sense of what the story is like because you're going to see all the characters, all the places and everything. So he saw all of that stuff and the character designs and he was supposed to send me a few of his ideas so that we could pick one of mm-hmm. them or maybe pick something that was inspired by that. But when he got mine, he saw all that imagination that I was going through. And it's because all my pitches were of different things. You had science fiction, you had a Western, you had a medieval adventure thing. You had so a contemporary thing, a thing in the future. So he saw all of that. And he told me, what if we did all of this together? And I told him, what the fuck do you mean? That's not a story. And he told me, no, listen to me. And he started talking about this like explosion of imagination and that, the creation would be part of the storytelling. Mm-hmm. Okay, this was all very vague, but this was basically the gist of it. And then we started talking back and forth, what could it be? And then he wrote like a two-line tagline for the mm-hmm. thing that he told me, okay, I still it down to this. What do you think? And it was like literally a tagline, very vague thing. And I said, all right. And then I did a small drawing, a couple of small drawings of whatever he was specifically mentioning it. And he told me, that's not really working. Why don't you do your thing based on our conversations? And I said, okay. And I started drawing like conceptual art for a script that didn't exist, mm-hmm. really. It was just based on our conversations. And my concern was at that time, this visually needs to belong together. But because I'm not writing it, I'm not concerned about who is who or who does what. Right. Like, let's create this world, the world that I see in my head after our conversations, and we'll go from mm-hmm. there. So I drew like dozens of characters and of places. And in each illustration, it was not just a place that I was drawing a place with characters doing things. So it was, you were like seeing this story happening, but it didn't have any kind of plot. It had story because it had some life instilled into it. It was literally conceptual art. And then I sent all that stuff to Brian, and he picked all that stuff, and he started writing ideas, like concise, big ideas with plot and all that. And he would start, and I remember that he asked me, like the only thing that he asked me from all the stuff that I designed for book one was a boy and a creature. Mm-hmm. That was it, which is the two of the main characters, which is Bolden and Spike. Spike is a creature. And I drew both of them. I loved them immediately. And I added a girl to it because I don't know. I felt like, let's add another mm-hmm. one. And I added the girl and I said, I really want this girl to be a part of it somehow. And it was the girl, which is Mathilde, with the round mm-hmm. helmet and the robot arm. And that really became the key core characters of the thing. And then because the characters were fully realized right away, because I drew like the design like it had a complete description. That's always how I do it. I play around with my pencil when I'm designing the characters, getting the shapes right. And then I do a very detailed type of character design already. So I sent all that stuff to him with a bunch of other characters. And then I remember that he was writing the script and he would tell me, for example, on page 11, three characters that you did on sheet number 5 appear.
Okay, sure.
Unless you don't like right. those. Unless you don't like those and you want to design some other yeah. characters. And then we were literally pointing at things and saying, oh, let's put the characters on mm-hmm. this, on that sketch right now. And then I would develop and flesh out the either the character or the place or whatever it was. But like all the stuff that you see on book one were designed previously of us having really a script mm-hmm. was, and that's like we inverted the process of creating this, which usually it's like you said in the beginning, the writer comes to you and says, I have got an idea that I think you want to be great for. That's usually how the conversation goes, you know. And on this case we went the other way around.
Okay, good. Sorry, there was a blink on this side. I think that's amazing. When I first picked the book up, I was, it sort of fit in a whole bunch of little categories that I enjoy. I love science fiction. It had a very sort of, for lack of a better term, a classic, D&D adventure kind of style, this yeah. small little adventuring party forming up.
Yeah.
And, all these kind of elements kind of came together, and then it was just in this landscape of this world, which was a mishmash of like things that seemed familiar and things that are completely just truly alien. And it's so interesting to hear how you all put, how you guys kind of connected this together, in the development age, which is pretty damn clever. I think that's amazing.
I was pulling from all of these, like visually speaking, the more I drew, the more I knew that I want this to be a like an old school adventure, like you got on the Japanese role-playing games. You know, that's where the D&D comes from you. But for me, like, to the point of view was the Final Fantasy games, Final Fantasy 7 or 8, or the old school mangas from the 90s, like Dragon Ball and all of that.
Yep.
There was always an adventure around the corner. There was always something new to see. And there was always this, on every game, on every episode, whatever it was, this brand new world for you to explore. And there was always something amazing coming. And you knew that this you could see the imagination of the author. So that's where I was picking it all from. And I think that's one of the good things actually about the book, is that me and Brian were taking inspiration from completely different things.
Mm-hmm.
And like when I was drawing, I was thinking about things that he doesn't even know exist. And the same thing for him. When he was writing, he was thinking of things that I had no idea that it existed. And when I explained it to each other, we then fed into each other's ideas. And there was always this ping pong back and forth. You know, when he started writing the characters, for example, I remember Brian telling me that it was on the script that Spike, so the creature, speaks like Larry David, which I never thought of. And then the moment that I read his dialogue as spoken by Larry David, it was like perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It's a voice for the character that I had never imagined it would exist. But it's like this mishmash. It's a good example of the mishmash that we got going through the entire thing.
Yeah. And like, I mean, your visual nods to, you know, three masters of the comic book form, you know, that you're infusing together in, you know, in the artwork. It's, you know, it's a nice homage, but it's also, it kind of makes sense on that creation aspect. Like you're like those three creators created so much, you know, that have influenced, you know, nearly the entirety of the industry. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of cool. Like, so you're kind of making a world that is sort of like the, I don't know, like, oh, you know, I don't want to say like the leftovers, but sort of like these sort of like interstitial crossed pieces of Otomo meeting Mobius and meeting, you know, Kirby. And like, there's just these little pockets, and in these pockets of creativity lie this world where you've gone in there as some sort of archaeologist, and you're like, oh, okay, I'm just going to grab all these pieces and make a whole new world from this stuff.
That's actually a perfect definition of the basic idea of what we had going through when we were making it. That's pretty much it.
Oh, I love
it. It's the cross section of everything.
I love it. So the first book came out last year, right? So was it a year ago?
Yeah. It was a year ago, yeah.
Okay, and then...
Or 2 years ago. No, it wasn't 2022 ago. Already.
Was it?
No, 2022
okay,
already.
Okay, 2022. Yeah. Okay, yeah. And then so the second one is coming out this April.
In a month.
Yes.
Yeah, so in just a month.
Yeah, so April...
So 23.
There you go, yeah. I almost remembered.
Yeah, it's like you can... It's all already available for pre-order everywhere and all that. And it's so people can go and search for it on Abrams website, mm-hmm. or on Amazon, or in your local comic book store, your preferred way of buying these things, whatever it is. As long as you buy it, as they say, we're fine.
Yeah, yeah, no.
And and we worked on, actually, we started working on book two like a year and couple of months ago. And I told Brian, what do you think? Because we knew that we had a trilogy in our hands. That was the deal that we signed with Abrams, and that was the story that we wanted to make. So I told him, what do you think about us making 2 and 3 back to back? You know, because otherwise for me it would be like I would have to draw this for 2 books back to back. It's not that easy to make, but at the same time, if I stop after book two and did something else, then I would need to come back and finish book three before not too long. So I thought to myself, it's going to be best if I can create this thing and then move to something else and have the possibility really of creating whatever I want, whatever the length it is. So we wrapped Phenomena in in its completion. We have book two and three. They are done at this point. And Abram is going to put book two now. I have it with me already. They already sent us a couple of copies each. It's beautiful. It's like, if you enjoy the first one as a book artifact, I think that Abrams did a really good job.
Yeah, it's
with
beautiful.
The printing and with the design and all of that. Yeah, it's really, when I got it, I was so excited. And book two is just the same thing, the same quality, same type of book exactly. So we're going to get that. And book three is sure to come out exactly at least 1 year from now. Possibly that's Abrams works with a... It was a funny process to go through because they work on a different way that we are used to in the comic book industry, in which you are making something that's going to come out in 3 months. And suddenly now we are making something that's going to come out in a year and a half. You know, it's a different way of working, but it's an interesting process as well. You have more time to tweak things if you like, to adjust, to... The process is very different. You get the copies for you to see if everything is all right and all those things. So it's going to be fun because book two is coming out. Book three is already done as well. So for me particularly, it's going to be a lot of fun to get something 1 year from now that I don't have to do pretty much anything.
Yeah.
It's like a free book.
It's almost, you know, I was going to say the same thing. I'm like, it's like almost a free book that you did. Yeah.
Yeah, because I did two and three. And when I was finishing three, I got two, my copy of two. It was done. It was processed. While they were processing two and designing it and printing it and all that, I was making three. So now that number two is coming out, I have already done three. So in a year from now, it's going to be like, oh, look,
yeah,
I did a book and I don't even remember doing it. Because for me, it's like I did just one big book.
You were wrapping up three, I think, when we were sort of arranging this, you know, when we were, you know, you were like, oh, yeah, no, I'm kind of wrapping up three. And I was like, what? Like, because of the timing didn't make sense in my head. And I was like, all right, well, and I thought you made a mistake at first. I thought like, oh, he's saying he meant to say two, but
no,
that's quite cool. And of course you're going to get more of my damn money because there's most likely going to be a compiled version of all three of these things if they sell well enough. And then I'll have to buy that too.
Oh, I hope so. Yeah, I hope so.
I don't have enough shelf space, Andre. What are you doing to me?
Yeah. Listen, I have a problem as well. Yeah. I'm looking at my shelves and this is terrible at this point. It's like an embarrassment almost, so many books. But that's what we do. We buy books.
I know. I think the destiny of every writer or comic book creator is to be buried underneath their love. Like, so they'll just be found. Well, eventually we'll all be found under a big pile of our own books and just they go, oh, well. Yeah, that was going to happen.
A beautiful death. That's what I'd say to that. Buried in books.
I love that. Cool. So book two, you can pre-order now. You know, I guess at this time, when this comes out, tell your local comic shop to go get one, or you can order right away from Barnes & Noble, Amazon, or Abrams.
Yeah.
I know. I pre-ordered. Website. I think I pre-ordered mine the second I saw. I think you guys put a notice up. I think Brian put a, hey, you can get this thing now. And I was like, all right, well, I'll get it now.
Yeah, it has been up for a few months, for a couple of months, the pre-order, I think, or at least a month and a few weeks. I don't remember exactly, but it has been for a bit.
I love pre-ordering books. And the reason why I like it is almost the same reason as you were talking about this. They're free comics and books when you get them. So if I pre-order a novel from, you know, an author I like or a comic book, and then I forget about it. And then, you know, the Batman Year One, the artist edition by, you know, from Mazzucchelli's artwork.
Yeah.
And I order it and like in the like, yeah, it's like September. I'm like, well, I'm gonna forget. So like September, a big old box is going to show up and I'm going to go, oh my gosh, you know, like I'll be so happy, but I'll have forgotten.
Yeah. You know, for years I got Kickstarter books that I bought. I bought like eight Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. I supported like eight Kickstarters in a year or something. And then for like 4 or 5 years, I kept receiving things that I had no idea what they were. And I was like, oh, it's this thing. And I was telling my wife, I was getting these boxes and I said, I have no idea what, I didn't order anything. Yeah. What is this? And I was like, oh, it's a Kickstarter that I bought in like 4 years ago.
Right before the kids were born.
I can remember what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's exactly before the kids were born.
No, it's totally nuts.
No, I remember that I moved houses like 6 years ago, and I got in my old mailbox, like I moved a couple of streets. Mm-hmm. So I usually take some walks during the day, and I was taking a walk and I looked at my old mailbox and there was a box sticking out because it wouldn't fit. And I said, that's probably a Kickstarter for me, but because I moved the house, it just came back to the old house. So I went there and it was a Kickstarter for me.
You're stealing other people's mail.
I went there.
That's all right. It's your, hey, listen, you got to do what you got to do.
It was mine, actually.
You got to do what you got to do. So are you doing any shows? Are you traveling this year? Are you going to go on vacations? Are you doing any conventions? Like what's your 2024 looking like?
So when it comes to conventions, I have been to one in Portugal and going to be in two more over here. So that's probably doesn't mean much for anyone in the United States, but I would love to return to New York Comic Con this year if I can make it. Mm-hmm. I'm going to try because it has been, I think my last time that I went there was in 2019.
Okay.
And like last year, Rick called me and he said, do you want to come to New York Comic Con? Because we have a big giant generator table so we can have as many people as we want there. And you know, he's going to have a bunch of artists there that are working with him as well. And we had been together in Barcelona a few months before, so it sounded very enticing, but I just couldn't make it because of work and all that.
Right.
And hopefully this year I can make it, but I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, also, you may be able to get in the Abrams table if at New York Comic Con.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's that. There's that we've talked about as well with Charlie.
Yeah, yeah.
Our editor, about that possibility, particularly with book two and book one already out there. So there's, you know, who knows at this point. There's nothing set in stone, but I'd love to come back anytime soon.
Yeah, not that I want to start a second podcast in the middle of or at the end of another podcast, but Charlie Kochman, let's just give it up for the man. The guy's the best.
Oh, Charlie's amazing.
He is the best.
When we were with Phenomena and trying to pick a publisher, so we had Janine, who is Brian's literary agent, and she was searching for a home for our book. And we actually had a bunch of people interested. So we went into a kind of auction. You know, we got into some meetings and talking to some people. And I remember like the first time that we got to Abrams, our first meeting on them through Zoom, you had the windows with the people speaking. And it was me, Charlie, Janine, and Brian. And I remember that Charlie, he went in, he started talking to us, super excited about the book. And then he said something like, oh, I forget something, let me just speak. And he went out of the window and me and Brian looked at each other and said, this is the guy that we want, because he was so excited about it. It was absolutely clear that it was going to be Abrams for us, you know, because he was just, he's very knowledgeable about comics. He was super, he was a champion of our project the way that it was. No changes, no nothing. He just wanted to bring our vision to the best package that he could get. And he proposed us to make a trilogy out of it, because at that point we had one book and we knew that we wanted to do more, but we weren't unsure how much more. And just talking to him, he knows so much about comics. He knows so many people. Any conversation that we have with him always end up with numerous stories about comics and about times past that he and Brian had with people that they both know and all that. So he's a super, super interesting, knowledgeable, great professional, great guy.
Yeah. So Charlie, I've known Charlie since like 1993, 94. Mm-hmm. And so he used to work for DC. So he'd been with DC mm-hmm. forever. And the summer of 94 in New York City. So I lived in New York City with me and my roommate, and it was scorching hot. It was our first summer in our apartment and we had no air conditioning, and we had the top floor apartment in a walk-up building, and it was
Jesus
Christ,
blazing
hot. We had a great big room, which was our studio, me and my buddy, and we each had our you know, in the windows, we had our drawing tables. It was, you know, the perfect setup. But we, I mean, the paper was sticking to our hands and our arms. Like, we couldn't draw. Like, the paper was mushy from the all the humidity. So we, our apartment was 6 or 7 blocks from DC Comics. So my roommate, Eric, calls up. I'm ratting you out, Eric, 35 years later, so take it. Or 30 years later. And he calls up Charlie, and Charlie's like, yeah, come on over. So DC had this weird building on 6th Avenue, and all the editorial was like kind of on one side, and then it went to the licensing group, which is where Charlie worked with. But then they had like the library. It was this weird, it was this 18-foot tall ceiling, like 2-story high room, you know, like on the 47th mm-hmm. floor of a giant building. And so they're like, so they snuck us in through like a side entrance, and they would let us come there like for a few weeks, like for 1 or 2 weeks. We went there every single day, Monday through Friday, with our portfolios and our drawing supplies, and we would sit there in this library drawing our pages. And then we saved up enough and got an air conditioner, and we didn't have to go in anymore. But like, I was doing Marvel pages in DC's offices to get
that's brilliant.
It was hilarious, but it was all because of Charlie. I mean, like, I'm sure he okayed it with his boss, Joe Orlando, but we would have been screwed if we didn't have but Eric, you know, sweet talked Charlie, and Charlie was like, yeah, no problem, I'll get you in. So
just another great story with Charlie.
The man's a champion for comic books. So cool. So
yes, he is.
I will put all your, you know, contact info, you know, social media stuff, website stuff in the description. Mm-hmm. So, you know,
oh, thanks.
All right, Andre, is this good? You okay? Nice conversation.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
I love the conversation.
I hope Michael Bay is okay with our conversation.
I hope too. I made a note of saying that I'm very fine with him doing the movies that he does. I hope he doesn't take it personally. I have no problem with it. It's just not my favorite kind of movie.
It's all right. But it's okay. You know, same.
I've enjoyed Bad Boys a lot.
Bad Boys was a really fun movie.
1 and 2.
Okay. Look at that.
A lot of funny lines. You couldn't make a lot of those dialogues these days. You know, there's a lot of racist jokes on 2 particularly. Between the Cubans and the Cuban cops and the 2 main characters, which I find funny, but it is what it is.
It is what it is. It is of the time as it was.
It is of the time, yeah.
All right, my friend. I appreciate it. Thank you so much for taking the time.
No, thank you very much. It was a fun interview. One of my favorites.